Okay. Let's get in our seats for the last speaker. Our last speaker for today is Angie Laird from the University of Texas Health Science Center at San Antonio.
Okay. Hi. So I was initially supposed to go first, which is why there's going to be a little bit of some of the more background information that we've already touched upon in some of the earlier talks. And Tor had to take an earlier flight, so I swapped with him. So you, just bear with me if we're sort of retouching things that we've already sort of hit upon. I want to start by talking about the BrainMap database, because although I was invited to give a talk on meta-analysis, the very symbiotic relationship that we have at the Health Science Center in San Antonio between the BrainMap database, our efforts in neuroinformatics, and meta-analysis, they're just so very linked that in order for me to talk about meta-analysis, I want to introduce to you what BrainMap is, even though we've had two speakers here who've already talked about it. Okay, so BrainMap is a neuroimaging database, but the difference between us and a lot of some of the earlier efforts in neuroinformatics is that it, rather than archiving raw data that has to be reanalyzed, we're a database of functional neuroimaging results, specifically coordinate-based results. So for all those papers that publish their Taylor-Ack or M&I coordinates of activation locations, we try and archive those along with the associated metadata. And from the beginning, BrainMap project was designed and conceived by Peter Fox, and who's the director of the lab that I work for, and all along he sort of envisioned as a tool for meta-analysis. And so here, the website for the project is brainmap.org, nice and easy to remember. And again, it's a database of functional neuroimaging studies, and you've all seen the ubiquitous pictures that are in every paper that we read about where we have our statistical parametric maps, statistical parametric images. And a good way of sort of condensing these results into tabular format is to go ahead and publish the XYZ coordinates of activation locations. And that's explicitly what we archive in the database, not the maps themselves, although we'd like to, and maybe potentially we'll move in that direction at some point, and not the raw data. There's a lot of inherent problems associated with archiving the raw data. And we feel that archiving the coordinates, some problems associated with the approximate nature of the coordinates, but also gets around some problems associated with the raw data. Now, the database itself, it's not just the coordinates and the citation information, but we've also conceived a what we call a coding scheme or a taxonomy of the metadata that's associated with each paper, with each experiment, that gets at the paradigm that was investigated, the cognitive domain that was under investigation, subject groups, ROIs, anatomical labels, all of these, all this metadata is attached to each of the coordinates so that you can get a full idea of the context of how these coordinates were derived. And so here's a screenshot of our data entry program. As Lars mentioned earlier in the social evolution paper that we wrote in 2005, we initially said, hey, there's this really great database that we have, and so we want you guys to take all your information about your paper and input it into the database and send it to us, and then we'll put it out there for all the world to see. And we pretty much got zero submissions because you guys have much better things to do with your time. And that was a problem for us. So after trial and error of a couple of different ways of going about this, we started using it as an in-house educational tool. Because for the novice student coming in, neuroimaging is just totally overwhelming trying to understand all the different methods associated. You know, how the data are acquired, and what about the subjects, and what about the paradigm, and blah, 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 blah. So we started teaching the students how to read papers. Basically, the introduction, it's great background information. But if you go straight to the methods section, you can really understand, as you're guided through the software, of what was done, what type of subjects, what conditions were they put under, which conditions were contrasted with each other to form statistical parametric images. Those images in BrainMap terminology are termed experiments. So anyways, we started inputting this data ourselves, and now we have a full-time team of two research assistants and a host of students who do the data entry for us. We're still not comprehensive of the literature, but we're making a really good effort at it. So again, we've got the coordinates of the activation locations, as well as the extent of activation, if that's published, which it's not always published. The standardized statistical parameters, again, not always published. And then every time a coordinate is input into the database, we run it through the TaylorAct daemon, which is our anatomical database, which assigns an anatomical label for each coordinate location in the brain. Here's just a quick little schema of our coding scheme, just to sort of show you the three different levels, paper level, experiment level, and location level. The three most interesting pieces of this coding scheme for me are behavioral domain, paradigm class, and context. That's sort of like the trifecta of how to understand what a paper was actually doing. Paradigm class is simple. It's those common everyday terms that people use to describe the paradigm, you know, Stroop, switching task, and back, those sort of names of what the people actually did. Behavioral domain gets at the cognitive process that was being investigated, memory, attention, action. And the context tries to look at what sort of effect you were trying to compare. If you were looking at just activations in normal subjects, then it's normal mapping. But if you were comparing normals versus elderly, then it's age effects. Or normals versus schizophrenics, then it's disease effects. So we feel that by looking at these three categories, you can really get at what a paper was trying to accomplish. Russ Poldrack gave a great talk at OHBM about the cognitive ontology that he's trying to build. And in it, he pointed out that our behavioral domain categorization is very, very coarse. And I 100% agree with that. Under cognition, we have a lot of subdivisions, one of which is attention. There's no subcategories listed under attention. And if you talk to any cognitive psychologist, they'll like freak out about that because there's lots of different ways of classifying attention. However, the point of BrainMap is to help you group papers that are similar. And so we don't want any bins of behavioral domains that have only one count in them. And so if you sit a bunch of scientists down and have them try and list what should be the attention subgroups, you'll get, for 20 different scientists, you'll get 20 different groups. And it becomes really ugly sometimes to have people yelling at each other, no, 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 you have to include this, no, 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 you have to include that. And so sort of where BrainMap sits right now is we're trying to say, okay, let's group things rather than separate them, and let you guys, once we've shown to you a group of similar studies, we'll let you separate them. That's sort of a naive approach in some ways, but there are a lot of ontological efforts out there that are going to try and help bridge the gap, so to speak. I don't know if anyone has talked about ontology in general. There are sort of ways of defining relationships between concepts, so that if I talk about executive function and you talk about cognitive control, the little computer that works between us says, hey, you guys are talking about the same thing, or at least sort of, so let's talk together. So they're not databases per se, but there are ways of linking ideas within a database. Okay, so back to BrainMap itself. This was sort of our idealized way of what we wanted BrainMap to be, in that you, the submitter, would take a paper and input the information into the Scribe software program that we have available for download, and you email it to us. We check it for quality control to make sure that, let's say you invented some new sort of paradigm class that we said, no, 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 we kind of have one that, you know, that's already there, that's close enough, let's put it with that. So we sort of check it and mold it a little bit, and then we upload it into the database, where after that point, you use the secondary piece of software called Sleuth, which allows you to query the database. And this is the one that's most popular with our users, because, you know, Scribe is the one that requires the work. So because this is sort of a summer school thing, and because I know everyone's always throwing software at you, I just thought I'd take you through a couple of slides just to give you a basic background of how Sleuth works, because it is pretty straightforward. You do have to have a username and password, and that's just so that we can sort of keep track of our user base, if it's growing or not, and you only have to enter it once, and then you're done with it. It saves all the information, because a lot of people complain about, I don't want to enter my password every time, I always forget. So anyways, you go ahead and log in to Sleuth, And there are buttons on the right, on the left, excuse me, buttons on the left, and each one of them opens up a different search panel that allows you to access different levels of search criteria. The buttons are for citations, so if you're looking for a paper published in 2005, or there's a subject group button that allows you to search by diagnosis if you're only interested in Alzheimer's patients. The conditions button gives you access to the stimulus type and modality, for example, visual words or auditory tones, and response type and modality, which would be hand and button press or mouth and speech, and then the instructions, generate, move, discriminate, those sort of things. And then we move on to the experiments panel, which has different information like that I talked about before, like the cognitive domain and the paradigm class and the context. And then we also have imaging modality and regions of interest. Regions of interest, you can either go by those Taylor Academy labels, like just left inferior frontal gyrus, or you can give a rectangular 3D shape and query all the coordinates that found activation within that rectangular shape. We're moving towards image-based ROIs so that you can take the FSL, Harvard-Oxford ROIs and query directly using those. But we're getting there. Hang on. Okay, so let's do a sample search. If you go to the experiments button and you go to paradigm class and select finger tapping, and then you hit start search on the bottom right-hand panel, this brings you to the search results panel, which is an intermediate panel. It's kind of a pain because you want to get to the good stuff, but this kind of just comes back and says, hey, you've got 5 papers. Okay, fine, I'll look at those and go on down to the workspace. But it may come back and say, we found 200 papers. You don't want to look at all those at once. You want to refine your search criteria a little bit more. But if you want to go ahead and download all of 57 that this found, it puts them all into the workspace, and at this point you can access all the information that was coded into the database using that Scribe program. And it includes the paradigm class and the coordinates and all the associated metadata. The last panel is the plot panel, which just puts the coordinates on a 3D glass frame in Taylor X space and allows you to click on each coordinate to query which paper it came from, where it's located, which contrast it came from, that sort of stuff. As I mentioned before, we do operate in Taylor X space. For any paper that's published using software that uses M&I coordinates, we go ahead and convert those coordinates to Taylor X space. And okay, brain freeze. Okay, so that's a little overview of what BrainMap is. And so now I'm going to go ahead and move into meta-analysis, which again would be great if I was the first speaker, because I have this lovely formal definition in which meta-analysis is known as the post-hoc combination of independently performed studies to better estimate a parameter of interest. And so meta-analysis for many years had a really bad rap in the field of clinical trials because a lot of people would take studies in which they did not find significant effects and pool all their data together and say, okay, maybe we can find significant effects now. Meta-analysis of human brain mapping is different because we're taking papers that have found significant effects, and we're looking for convergence in location. So we like to refer to this as a location effects meta-analysis. And so we've got this combination of statistically significant effects to create predictive models of, for a given of task, which areas of activation should I expect to see. Okay, so we all know that fMRI and PET are powerful for localizing brain functions, and the results that you'll see will often depend on, you know, the exact experimental paradigm that you use or the software that you use, some of the pre-processing steps that you use. Then you also have high variability due to biological issues or SNR or a low number of subjects. So any given study may give you outlier results, but we've got lots of studies. And so just as Tor showed you, when people talk about meta-analysis, they like to give the big figure of how many papers have been published recently. This is a little bit misleading because we are talking about coordinate-based meta-analyses. And so the basic premise here is that people actually have to publish their Taylorite coordinates. Please publish your Taylorite coordinates. It's great. It helps us out. This plot here has to be downward corrected for all the papers that actually don't publish their coordinates. And usually it can tend to be a pretty significant figure of papers that we have to omit from a meta-analysis just because they didn't publish their coordinates. Meta-analysis has sort of been around in this field for a very long time, but it had its origins in what, you know, just a basic review. And one of the types of these sort of textual review, where you can have just sort of listing of papers that came before you, and well, what did they find? Well, what did they find? And just a verbal representation about previous results. Or you can have simple listing of tables. I find these difficult to interpret and not always such a big help. Another way of doing it is to do a tabular review, in which we've got here precentral gyrus, and we've got a bar graph tally of how many times a precentral gyrus was found to be activated in the given group of papers that we are meta-analyzing. The spatial specificity of this type of review is not so good. For example, the anterior cingulate gyrus, or the cingulate gyrus, it's really big. And, you know, we've got, in this particular one, it was a tabular review of the Stroop papers. We've got anterior cingulate here, but then we've also got inferior frontal gyrus, which is very large, and we have a much larger count of that. And we found that once you looked at the convergence of these foci, they were all over the place, and there really was no convergence. The next type of way of doing a review is to do a graphic representation, where you simply line up your coordinates on a standard brain in different colors that correspond to different task categories or subject groups, and look to see where they all lie. So what we like is the evolution in recent years of the popularity of quantitative coordinate-based voxel-wise meta-analyses. And Tor talked to you about the KDA and the MKDA, and also about ALE, Activation Likelihood Estimation, which was originally developed by Peter Turkletaub in 2002. And when he published he gave a talk at OHBM, I think 2002, 2003, afterwards Peter Fox came up to him and said, that's what I've been looking for my brain map database. And so they got together and I joined the group, and we sort of took the ALE method and ran with it. And 2005, we published a modification that included a few upgrades and its incorporation within the brain map structure. So the basic thing to understand about ALE is that reported coordinates are not treated as discrete points of activation, but centers of probability distributions. This is just to say that, you know, we want to take that coordinate point that was published in the paper and just blur it back to approximate what it actually looked like when it was a cluster. This is a very rough approximation. We lose a lot of spatial information, but this is our way of doing the best we can with what we have to work with, because we don't have those statistical parametric images. So each reported activation is modeled by a 3D Gaussian distribution. And so for multiple sets of coordinates, we want to evaluate the union of these distributions for all brain locations to create a whole brain statistical map. And this estimates the likelihood of activation for each voxel in the brain. So here's my one required formula. If we let X of I denote the event that the ith focus is in a given voxel, then the probability of X of I of occurring is given by the formula here, where D sub I is the Euclidean distance between the focus and the voxel, and the sigma is your standard deviation of your Gaussian. So the first presentation of the ALE method was a meta-analysis of single word reading that was done by Peter Turkletaub. And this is taken directly from his paper, where he looked at Medline and PubMed to find the articles that he was interested in, and limited those to those that actually reported the coordinates, what we actually need to do the analysis, and looked for the contrast where he was comparing an activation condition to a control condition, and then did a calculated the ALE statistic at each voxel in the brain and did a non-parametric permutation test to determine which voxels were statistically significant. In his paper, he had 11 papers with 172 foci, and you can see here it's a very diffuse pattern. I mean, you can tell that there's some convergence going on, but the ALE analysis revealed, on the left, he has the meta-analysis results, which show the areas of convergence according to the published literature, which focused at that time, since it was single-word reading, they were all PET papers. He then did a validation study to compare his meta-analysis to an fMRI study where he did a jittered acquisition so that he could do overt speech, and found that the agreement between the validation fMRI and the meta-analysis agreed quite nicely. So, again, we went ahead and took his algorithm and ran with it. And as an example here, just to sort of make sure we understand what's going on, is I'm going to talk about a meta-analysis on finger tapping studies. And so in BrainMap, we've got 38 papers, 73 experiments, 347 subjects with 663 activation foci. I really like the big meta-analyses. We've been doing some large-scale ones now that deal with thousands of coordinates, and that gets really exciting because it's so much more powerful. The most popular question I'm always asked on the forums is, well, how many coordinates do I need to do a meta-analysis? And it's not really a straightforward answer, because when you're talking about simple sensory paradigms, you're talking about fewer regions, so it's more about the consistency of the results, whereas for larger, more cognitively related networks, there's going to be more regions, you're going to need more data. But the little rough answer that I tend to give is nothing less than 100 coordinates. So anyways, for example, here are the activation foci for the finger tapping, and we want to know where they converge. And you can see here that there's little areas that we can tell there's some convergence going on, but we're not really convinced. Now again, if we go back to the original papers that constructed this data set, we've got the Becker paper here that has its coordinates, and the Gerardine paper that has its coordinates, and what we're doing is we're blurring these coordinates so that we're getting back an approximation of what the maps look like when they were first analyzed. And we want to put all of them together and look at the union of this Gaussian approximation. And then after that, we have to figure out which ones are significant. And so for the finger tapping meta-analysis, we determined these were the significant areas for our finger tapping regions, and then also ran a secondary experiment where we again ran our own finger tapping data and found good agreement between the two maps. So there's AIL, that's what it can do. The third piece of software that's associated with the BrainMap database is Ginger Ale, because we had to give it a cute name. It's now GUI based, or it has a nice GUI, it's image based now, it works with nifty images. And again, it operates in TaylorX space, although I need to update that. We just released a beta version now. You can do meta-analyses in either MNI space or TaylorX space, because people usually have a very emphatic position on which side of that line they stand on. So the permutation test is now corrected for multiple comparisons and allows for comparisons between two groups of foci. So if you want to compare the NBAC to the Stroop, you can look for significant regions of difference between those two tasks. So as an example, I'm just going to go over the Stroop meta-analysis that we published a couple of years ago. And in the Stroop task, subject view color names that are printed in different ink colors, and the incongruent condition, the ink colors do not agree with the actual color name that is given. And so this task is universally recognized as a standard in examining the neural substrates of attentional control, because the correct performance in color naming often competes with a relatively automatic tendency for word reading. So the objective of our Stroop meta-analysis was to identify the regions of concordance among these papers to understand the detection of conflict and response selection in this task. And so whenever I present a meta-analysis, this slide is the most important, because when you publish a meta-analysis, you need to be really clear of what papers you included and which ones you excluded, because that, you know, that comes down to what you find and what you don't find. We did a Medline search in PubMed and used the BrainMap database to look for papers that had the keyword of Stroop in them. Stroop was easy because you know what Stroop is. Stroop is always called Stroop is always called Stroop. When you're looking at memory tasks, it gets a lot different because everybody calls things different names, which again is why ontologies are going to be really important in the future of this field, so that we can sort of link concepts together. Again, we have to downsample our entire group just to limit it to those that report standardized coordinates, and we were looking for very simple contrast of incongruent minus control. Telling people what contrast you isolated is very important too, because you know, you can look at the Stroop task and or the Stroop papers, and you can have, well, I compared this subject group to that subject group. Well, you don't want to compare those coordinates to ones that looked at incongruent minus control in this subject group. So you have to be very clear about which experiments you're actually including. We filtered out task variations like the emotional Stroop and the counting Stroop. We looked at normal subjects only, group data only. We didn't use a couple of earlier papers that published coordinates on individual subjects, because then that gave unfair weighting to those papers because they had so many more coordinates than another paper that only published a group study. And we did not include any deactivations, since that's a very physiological difference between deactivations and activations. And that left us with 19 contrasts and 205 foci. And to get at a question that was asked earlier, I also don't think that you should include ROI-based studies in a meta-analysis, because we're looking at effects across the whole brain. And if you include a paper that says, well, I'm only going to include my amygdala activations, or I'm only going to include my prefrontal activations, then that's not really giving full weight to the rest of the studies. However, the caveat to that is what sometimes you want to look at things that you're limited by what the literature is giving you. And so what we like to do is to do meta-analysis, number one, that's just the whole brain activation. So I'm going to show you those results. And then, a supplementary meta-analysis is, let me go ahead and put in the ones that are ROI-based, because we're letting you know that they're going to be unfairly weighted. But we do want to see what these convergence for these ROI-based regions are. So I think that's sort of a good compromise in how to get around that issue. So here for the Stroop, we did three different meta-analyses, one for all coordinates for the Stroop, and that was all 205 foci. And then we limited to those that did a verbal or oral response, either overt or covert, and that was 152 foci. And then we did a third meta-analysis for ones that used a manual button press meta-analysis, and that was 53. And again, that's a really small number, but we wanted to make the comparison, and so we went ahead and went forward with that smaller meta-analysis. We used a full-width half-max of 10 millimeters. I like 10 to 12. I think the 14 to 15 is a little bit too high. Things get a little too blurry. And then used 5,000 permutations in our permutation test. So the top line shows some slices from the pooled Stroop where we had high degree of convergence in the anterior cingulate gyrus, bilateral frontal areas, bilateral insula. And the middle slide here shows the verbal Stroop results where we found bilateral insula and left inferior frontal gyrus near Brabant area 44, two areas known to be involved in articulation, whereas the manual Stroop on the bottom found, again, the anterior cingulate gyrus and a few other areas, but notably missing were those areas associated with speech production. So we wanted to know, now that you can see the three separate meta-analyses, where are the overlap areas between the verbal Stroop and the manual Stroop? And so we created a composite image just by lining them up all on the same image, and we found three areas of overlap in the anterior cingulate gyrus, which again was the largest area of convergence across the different meta-analyses, and the left inferior frontal junction, which lies between the precentral and inferior frontal gyri, and then the left inferior parietal lobule. And because these showed up consistently in both the verbal and the manual Stroop, we believe that they are critical to performance of the Stroop task, regardless of the task type. So now, there has been some conflict in published studies about whether or not there is somatotopy within the singular motor area. Some papers say that they have evidence that it has, and some papers say no. So we wanted to look at this a little bit more closely, so we sort of zoomed in on the cingulate motor area, and we found high AL values along the length of the cingulate sulcus. It was rostral to the VCA, which is the vertical plane that passes through the anterior commissure. And we observed multiple distinct regions for both verbal and manual Stroop, with our verbal in red and our manual in blue, and the yellow shows the overlap. We found two regions in the anterior portion of the rostral cingulate zone and two regions in the posterior portion of the rostral cingulate zone, both one manual and one verbal. So this actually agrees nicely with a paper done by Tomas Paus, where he found two verbal areas in the RCCA, and then two manual areas. However, he did find his second manual area to be located in the caudal cingulate zone, and we had a slight disagreement with the aligning of that, but still quite similar. Another paper done that did find somatotopic mapping in the anterior cingulate gyrus was by Picard and Strick, where again, two verbal areas, one in the RCCA, one in the RCCP, and two manual areas, one in the RCCA, one in the RCCP. He also found this fifth area in the CCZ, which we didn't find anything like that. But we were sort of pleased that this very simple method of just doing a Gaussian approximation of the coordinates gave us a very fine detail of things lining up with previous points in the literature. So the conclusion of that story was that we used the AOMET analysis to identify three regions, the anterior cingulate gyrus, the left infrontal junction, and the left inferior parietal lobule, that we believe are crucial to task performance in both the verbal and the manual stroop. And we looked at the cingulate motor areas and agreed that with previous studies that found evidence for somatotopy based on the response modality. And in that, we had a verbal and a manual region in both the anterior and posterior portion of the rostral cingulate motor zone. Okay, so we've been doing these meta-analyses for, goodness, it's 2008? Wow, 6 years now. And we've had a lot of time to sort of go through some a number of them. We've done them on the primary systems like action, perception, which includes, you know, the five senses, audition, vision, gustation, olfaction, and somatosensation. We've also extended that to include some on pain. We're looking at interoception, which are those stimuli that have origin within your body, bladder function, sexuality, air hunger, food hunger. And then we've looked at a lot of meta-analyses of higher cognition, such as calculation, emotion, lots of language ones, mental rotation, and a lot of different paradigms that I've got listed here. A number of these are published, a number of these aren't. These are some that we sort of continually cycle through because BrainMap's secondary goal is to really work towards an atlas of human brain function, which I'll get at a little bit later. The other thing is to look at a number of studies that compare different subject groups, and I believe we've published on all of these, of looking at depressed subjects, schizophrenics, we've got a number of those done, stuttering, and obsessive compulsive disorder. So we've got a real nice sort of, the word that comes to mind is database. It's sort of like a database of a database, right? Because we're working on a number of these different meta-analyses that we've got archived. So recently, we sort of had a couple of investigators come to us and say, we want to do a meta-analysis, not of functional neuroimaging studies, but of structural neuroimaging studies. In basic brain morphology studies, people use, generally, ROI approaches. And doing meta-analysis of this kind of study is generally problematic because you've got a lot of different analysis issues to take into account. For example, manually or automatically delineate ROIs, procedures that differ between laboratories and different labels, and then we've got bias based on all these different choices. And so doing a meta-analysis of brain morphology studies can be generally very difficult. However, we have the great VBM, which has some good features to it. VBM, I believe you guys would have learned about last week, is the Voxelwise comparison of the local concentration of gray matter or white matter or CSF between two groups of subjects. And so in VBM, we look at high-resolution neuroimages from two different populations, for example, schizophrenics versus controls. And after spatial normalization, segmentation into gray matter, white matter, and CSF, and smoothing, the group-level difference are analyzed between aligned voxels. And the output is images that identify significant differences between the two groups. So the output is actually a statistical parametric image. And so you can extract then the XYZ coordinates in stereotactic space. So we've had a sort of request from the community to expand BrainMap to encompass not only functional neuroimaging studies, but structural neuroimaging studies, specifically those that investigate VBM. and we're currently finishing up the final touches of releasing this database. The literature for VBM is a lot smaller than the literature for functional studies. It's less than 500 that actually publish the coordinates and do VBM as explicitly defined by Ashburner and Friston. And so we've actually been able to harness that literature, and we're working the details of the new software to go with it. It's going to sort of complement BrainMap. It's going to have separate query tools, and you're going to it'll link to the functional studies, but we're still working out the kinks. We'll get it out there, though. So anyways, we're going to expand BrainMap to include VBM studies. And as a tester, we wanted to do a meta-analysis of VBM and schizophrenia. And so we went to the literature and we looked for papers that reported whole brain results in the coordinate format that included a comparison of schizophrenic subjects and healthy comparisons, and followed those VBM protocols that have been delineated by Ashburner and Friston. We did not want to look at studies that reported changes over time, included individuals who are at risk for schizophrenia but didn't actually have the disorder, and we weren't interested in including a contrast of treatment effects or substance use effects. So regardless of all these papers that we excluded, we still were left with 31 papers that had over 1,000 patients and 1,200 healthy controls. So we used ALE, which we kind of tweaked the wording to call it anatomic likelihood estimation because the activation was taken away. Took us a while to come up with how to change that. And we looked at two different comparisons. One where we saw regions of controls greater than schizophrenics. That was 315 foci. And then a smaller group of comparisons where schizophrenics were greater controls. We operate in Taylor-X space whenever we do an AO meta-analysis. And we used a new transform to go between Taylor-Eck and M&I space, a new coordinate matrix transformation that's been published in 2007 by Jacqueline Castor, who's also in our lab. And this is a slight correction over the Brett's M&I to Tau transform. So we used that to convert any M&I coordinates to Taylor-Eck space. If someone had used the Brett's M&I to Tau, we undid that transformation and then redid it using our correction because it has shown to have better fit when correcting between the two spaces. We used the ginger ale software and a full width half max of 12 millimeters. And we ended up with this map where the increases in controls are in the warm colors and the increases in patients are in the cool colors. And I won't get into all the specific details of the areas, but we'll point you to two different papers that we wrote based on VBM and schizophrenia. One that's in biological psychiatry and the other's in American Journal of Psychiatry. So that's just to let you know that, you know, you can use meta-analysis not just for functional imaging studies, but also for structural. So we're trying to sort of increase the diversity of things that you can do with the meta-analysis method. So when Tor started his talk, he gave you a lot of reasons of why we should do meta-analysis, and I totally 100% agree with all of them that he said, but I have a couple of my own. And I'd like to point this out here towards the end because people are publishing more and more meta-analyses, and a lot of the ones that we're asked to review, a lot of people just say, okay, here's my papers, here are the areas, done. And we really want there to be a bigger motivation, a bigger understanding of how this can actually be helpful and useful. And so it's not just about saying, okay, here's my regions, but here's a couple examples of how these things can really be useful. First one is resolving conflict between existing studies. Tor pointed out the disgust in the insula, how meta-analysis was useful in that. My example was the somatotopic mapping in the anterior cingulate gyrus. And so a lot of times you do have a lot of papers that sort of argue back and forth, and meta-analysis can really sort of nail that down. Second example is generate new hypotheses. We had a special issue of meta-analysis come out in Human Brain Mapping in 2005 where we invited a lot of our collaborators to go ahead and publish different meta-analyses on different topics. And one of them was our some people that we collaborate with in Germany where they looked at the switching tasks and the Stroop task. And, you know, when you look at the Stroop literature, as I did when I was doing my Stroop meta-analysis, you can really just totally get overwhelmed with anterior cingulate, anterior cingulate, anterior cingulate. And it's like the first guy, that's all he talked about. And so the second guy, he talked about that a lot too. And then the third, and it's this sort of steamroll effect where the literature is guiding the literature because people are talking about certain things. And what Durfus et al. Noticed in 2005 is that there's this other region called I'm not sure if they coined the term, but that inferior frontal junction located between precentral and inferior frontal gyri, that it popped up just as much, and nobody was talking about it, and it was a very discrete region. And so by doing a meta-analysis, we sort of let the data tell us the important regions rather than, just letting things sort of propagate by what certain authors focus on. Third reason here why I think meta-analysis is cool was an abstract that I stumbled upon at OHBM in Melbourne this year that I really wish I had a pointer to, and I've got nothing. I need to go back and get it. But they actually used spatial pattern matching to identify their ICA components. So they did a meta-analysis of an area that they were investigated in, and then they ran ICA on their data, and they helped choose their pattern that they were interested in based on the meta-analysis results. So I'm going to be looking for that paper because I thought it was just a different use of meta-analysis than what I've seen before. The fourth reason is something that I'm actually really interested in because I'm very interested in effective connectivity and structural equation modeling. And one of the big problems in SEM and some of the other methods is that you start with this model that you come up with from anatomic studies or other functional studies, but it's basically your idea of the interactions that are going on during the performance of a task. And the very first thing that you do is you take your data set and you condense it down to a number of discrete ROIs. And a lot of people do this just by simply their preconceived notions of what they believe to be involved in the task. And a lot of people do it by just doing an activation analysis and taking the significant areas. But I like to use meta-analysis for this. We recently published a structural equation modeling paper of transcranial magnetic stimulation of primary motor cortex. And we looked in our data to find different ROIs, and the way that we chose the ROIs were to first run a meta-analysis of all the TMS papers that have probed LM1 that were in the literature. It was actually 9 papers with 11 experiments and 102 foci. Again, not a huge meta-analysis, but it really gave us a good starting point to go ahead and help us select ROIs for our SEM model that we applied later on in our own data. We won't get into what the paper actually did and all the model and everything, but the point is that I'd like to make here is that the AL meta-analysis of the TMS studies agreed really well with the activation analysis of our TMS PET data. So our data agreed with meta-analysis data. That gave us more confidence that we were looking at the right ROIs. We were doing this as an investigation of motor connectivity of the motor system. So we ran not only the TMS meta-analysis, but also a meta-analysis of finger tapping, and we found really good overlap between those two systems as well. So we really feel that by using meta-analysis to help seed ROIs for structural equation modeling, that you're sort of giving a little bit of oomph to how you do your ROI selection. Again, I talked a little bit earlier about how we're going to be using brain maps to sort of create this human brain atlas of brain function. And we're doing that by running large-scale meta-analyses of all action papers, all language papers, all memory papers, and creating these spatial networks to represent the general areas of activation known to be associated with these very broad categories. We also have a behavioral domain profile feature to the database that we've released, and that is displayed by the histogram here, that if you do an ROI search and you select a rectangular ROI in the database and say zoom it in on primary motor cortex, and then you click behavioral domain profile, this histogram will come up, and the top level shows you all the behavioral domains that are associated with all the coordinates in that region. And the bottom level shows you what the whole database looks like, so you can see how we're skewed. The very on the bottom here, the very large orange bar, That's cognition. So you can tell we have lots of cognition papers in the database, while maybe not so many emotion. Well, that's just how the literature is weighted. But the point is that you can use these behavioral domain profiles to sort of give you a mathematical representation of, well, yeah, you see that paper a lot in emotion, but you also see it a lot in memory. And so we're sort of trying to tweak different ways of comparing ROIs based on these behavioral domain profiles. Another thing we're doing is using meta-analysis to study functional connectivity. We want to look at co-occurrence. When region X is on, is region Y on? And so we looked at seeding an ROI in one of the left amygdala and one of the right amygdala. And we probed the database to say, okay, here's my left amygdala, and find me all the papers that have activation in this area. Okay, now download the rest of the coordinates and run a meta-analysis so that I can see if the amygdala is on, what else is on, and then do that for the corresponding right amygdala and then compare. And so we like to view this as a sort of meta-analytic way of getting at functional connectivity. And you can see here are the results for our left amygdala and right amygdala connectivity studies. Excuse me. And then we also did this for an investigation of the default mode network, where, and I did present this in Melbourne as a poster, where we looked at all the deactivations that were coded in BrainMap, did a meta-analysis of those, and then zoomed in, say, on the ventral anterior cingulate here, used that ROI to seed a search looking for all the papers that found activation in the ventral anterior cingulate so that we can compare when ventral anterior cingulate is a deactivation, what do those spatial patterns look like as compared to when it's an activation, and then looking at the corresponding behavioral domain profiles to look at differences as we go across the three regions that are generally seen in the default mode network, ventral anterior cingulate, posterior cingulate, and precuneus. The one thing that was really interesting about that is that the color coding here is that red are the deactivations and that green are the corresponding activations. And so you can see there's a not a whole lot of overlap between the ventral anterior cingulate activation deactivation and precuneus activation deactivation. But the PCC, its activation patterns looked a lot like its deactivation patterns. And it's really been sort of highlighted in the default mode literature as being very, very critical in the default mode network. And we feel that this meta-analytic way of looking at things also supports that claim. So that's all I have for today. And I'd like to thank, again, all my collaborators at the Research Imaging Center at UTESGA, and both in our at the RSC and in psychiatry. And then special thanks to all my great collaborators that that I work with over the last few years, and also our funding. Thank you.
Does anyone have any questions for Angie? Yes, Stephen.
Are you databasing the meta-analytic results, particularly the ones you're doing in your own group, so people can compare as they, for example, pilot experiments, etc.?
We haven't released it to the public yet, but we are, and we plan to as soon as we get it organized. It's tough because it's continually changing, but so we wanted to sort of reach a critical mass before we put it out there. But yeah, absolutely, because that we want that to be then the functional atlas.
It's probably as useful as the larger database itself.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. So yeah, that'll definitely be coming as soon as we sort of get it out there.
Can I ask another one?
Yeah.
So what do you
this
think
is your
about
last one now?
How do you think about using these techniques to go across subjects?
What do you mean?
Well, treat the subjects as the experimental results. I mean, there's no particular reason that we should analyze groups of 10 subjects or 20 subjects. Each subject themselves is really their own experiment.
Sure.
And you can go ahead and you could database at the subject level, for example.
A coordinate-based database at the subject level?
You'd probably be better to do SPMs. But, I mean, you can use ALE. We've done it. I'm just wondering if anyone else has done it.
I have no problem with it. We have a very strong collaboration with the FBurn group, and so we sort of leave the individual subject stuff to them. In fact, that's a major sort of point of, oh yeah, we can't talk, we're talking about different things, because I work a lot with Jessica Turner, and she's always like, oh yeah, you're groups, and I'm like, oh yeah, you're individual subjects, because it's very different when you're talking about the same things. But yeah, I mean, what I like about ALE is its simplicity, is that, yeah, you're losing a lot of information, and yeah, you don't have the original maps, and yes, everyone thresholds at different levels, but we've implemented tests of a lot of different corrections for a lot of these different issues, and we're sort of getting the same results. So, I don't know, I sort of got off topic of your answer, but there you go. Okay.
Question right there.
A lot of people do that. That was why I made... Okay, finish your question.
So that's actually... we wouldn't find that... how do we know that if we're doing a meta-analysis study and finding a region, it's not that kind of a...
People tend to be clear in their tables. I mean, they're so unclear about so many different things, which is why I like to use this sort of forum to say... please be clear in your papers as to what you're doing. But they tend to be very clear in those sorts of papers to say amygdala activations or prefrontal activations. And so you do get a general idea whether or not they're really showing you all the data or not showing you all the data. There's always some exceptions. But you tend to know if you're seeing all of it or not. And in that case, you're not going to get the answer that you want. They've clearly left out some things. Again, it's tough sometimes to be a meta-analyst and to spend all my time working on something that is so dependent on what people are publishing. And, it can get disheartening sometimes.
Yeah, because everybody could be wrong.
Yeah. So that's why I'm here, saying, hey, there's this really cool thing called meta-analysis, and it all relies on everybody being really open about their coordinates. And you can focus your paper on the amygdala and talk a lot about it, but list, even if it's in the supplementary online information, list all your coordinates, because that helps other people who are looking at other regions. So the answer to your question is, yeah, you're screwed. Right?
Yeah, how about the coordinates? People may eventually not report the coordinates, but report instead either macro polygon names, microscopical names like Rodman areas, or macro anatomical like superior frontal gyrus, or functional names like SNA, U1.
Yeah.
Can you convert that to coordinates and put it in the database, or you just...
No, you say, I have to exclude that study. So, yeah, you miss a good portion of the literature if they don't give coordinates. Yeah.
So I noticed in Scribe that you have a spot where you can note spatial extent, and all of these voxels that you're putting are peak voxels, which may or may not be representative of the actual cluster. So how do you deal with that, and are you working on some ways to handle that problem?
Yeah, and Tor kind of hit on that earlier, because a lot of people, they have a nice big cluster, and they'll report one peak voxel, or they'll report, like he said, four submaxima. We're working on, I've been actually working with Simon Eickhoff recently and trying to work on some changes to ALE, and we're working on a manuscript that sort of implements a lot of these modifications to address some of the concerns that Tor brought up. For that particular one, we're not exactly sure what to do, so it is a problem. Well, we use Sleuth to search the database for papers of interest, and then there's an export function that'll actually take all the coordinates from your workspace and put them in a nice little text file, and Ginger Ale, that's a format that, that Ginger Ale likes. So you go directly between the two softwares with an export function.
Okay, any last questions for Angie before we wrap up today's session? All right, well, let's thank Angie again and Lars and Paul.